headlines this hour, Iran says the new round of talks on the JCPOA revival is focused on finding a mechanism for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. Another Israeli demolition in the occupied West Bank. Army bulldozers wreck an under-construction Palestinian home. And China expands lockdowns in northern cities in a race to contain a surge in COVID cases that have reached a 21-month high. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Happening today in Vienna, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are holding the second day of fresh negotiations on the revival of the agreement. Tehran says verifying the removal of U.S. sanctions, as well as guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again, are at the heart of the conversation during the eighth round that's ongoing. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagherikani says the two sides do have an agreement in principle, but will now work on practical mechanisms to make that happen. According to the envoy, the talks will also examine the financial and banking sanctions against Iran. Bagherikani says all the participant states have acknowledged the achievements made so far. During the last round, Tehran presented two separate proposals on the removal of U.S. sanctions, as well as Iran's commitments under the JCPOA. A correspondent in Vienna, Homolesky, joined us earlier with more details on the ongoing sanctions removal talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal.
From this day on, from this stage, the expert working groups are going to begin their work on the issues on the table, and the priority now, they say, is sanctions removal. And in the context of sanctions removal, Iran's proposals on verification and guarantees are also going to be up for discussions. Now, of course, these are considered among the main sticking points, so we'll have to see where negotiations lead in that respect. As Mr. Mora said in the previous round, if 80% of the draft text of a final agreement is done, there's still 20% where disagreements or the main sticking points remain. Iran has said at the beginning of the seventh round and with the introduction of the new Iranian team that's representing the new government that it wants to include some additional proposals, and I think some of them concern the issue of verification and guarantees. When we were speaking to Mr. Bagheri last night after the Joint Commission sessions, and also on the issue of guarantees, he was giving us some explanation, saying that what Iran means by this is that it wants to get some tangible guarantees from the other side that it can rely upon, based on which the U.S. would not be able to withdraw again from the JCPOA or to impose sanctions that would be in violation of the JCPOA.
Well, Israeli forces are pressing ahead with their land grab projects in the occupied territories. This time, they've demolished the home of a Palestinian family who was building in the West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Just a day earlier, regime forces destroyed another home and 10 commercial structures in and around Al-Quds. Israel says these structures are built without a permit. And although these permits are impossible to obtain, the regime uses this excuse to tear them down. Rights groups say that Tel Aviv is grabbing more Palestinian land to expand its illegal settlements. According to a report by the UN, the number of Palestinian structures confiscated or demolished increased by 21% this year. The Palestinian prisoner who has been on a hunger strike for more than 4 months is in critical condition. During our news review program, we discussed the protest action and the illegal Israeli detentions with our guests. Here's a look at what they had to say. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. A Palestinian prisoner's condition is worsening progressively after being on a hunger strike for months. Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for more than 130 days to protest his detention without charge by Israel. The 40-year-old man has lost a lot of weight and is reportedly unable to move and speak normally. Israeli authorities have suspended his administrative detention order because of his critical condition. Abu Hawash is now in a civilian hospital, but his relatives are not allowed to visit him. He is among several other hunger-striking Palestinians who are demanding an end to Israel's indefinite detentions without charge. The practice is illegal under international law. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. He told us more about his conditions And also we have Seth Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University, who joins us also from occupied Ramallah. All right, so Mona, tell us about the health condition of this particular prisoner, and if you have information on other prisoners as to how they are doing, and of course, if they're being tended to at this point.
Hisham Abu Hawash, this Palestinian prisoner who started his open-ended hunger strike over 133 days, was transferred to the Israeli hospital of Asaf Harove after he started to face a risk of sudden health setback that literally, according to the doctors and his lawyers, could lead to his death. He's facing serious heart problems, as well as in the kidney and the liver as well. The Israeli authorities decided to freeze the administrative detention of Hisham Abu Hawash. However, Hisham refused to end his open-ended hunger strike because he's demanding for the end of his detention and not a freeze, because the freeze means that the Israeli prison authorities could anytime return Hisham to the administrative detention after he ends his open-ended hunger strike. That's why he's insisting to receive an end to his detention and a decision to release him. Otherwise, he made it clear, according to his wife, that he's willing to pass away in the Israeli jail, but not to end his open-ended hunger strike without achieving the victory that is ending the detention, because he is being detained illegally under the so-called administrative detention policy.
Well, that's the whole problem there, Saad Nim, isn't it, that this detention without charge is an illegal act. It's not internationally recognized, obviously, but governments around the world do this. The Israeli entity does that on a rather frequent basis. Is administrative detention, the way they term it, based on any reason or logic, or is it used as a scare tactic to prevent Palestinians in their eyes from doing things that they shouldn't do, as they see it?
In reality, the administrative arrest is designed and created by the British mandate in 1945 as a military law. Since the establishment of the State of Israel, they kept this law and they start to use it against the Palestinians, and especially after 1967 war and the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem. What happened that since that time, the Israelis are using the administrative arrest, which is absolutely internationally illegal, and from the all points of view, especially the human rights organization, consider it as a kind of a barbarian law, because they allow the Israeli authorities to arrest any Palestinians without pressing charges, without even interrogation, and without trial. And they will go from a period of 6 months to another, even to renew the administrative arrest. We have cases in Palestine that people had spent 12 years in a row under administrative arrest. Now, the administrative arrest, since there is no charges, it's the right of the Palestinian to know why I am arrested, or otherwise release me. Because of that, there is this hunger strike going on by Palestinians. Now we are talking about around 500 Palestinians in the prisons under the administrative arrest or detention, and some of them is going on into these hunger strikes. Last month there was four or five of them. Now we have the Hisham Abu Hawash, who's entering his 134 days in a hunger strike, in order that the Israeli will determine if he is going to end this term of administrative arrest, or they are not going to renew a new one, and when he's going to be released.
Okay.
According to that, he's continuing with his hunger strike.
Thank you, Mona Kandil. We appreciate it from Occupied Ramallah, and also from Occupied Ramallah, Saad Nim. Thank you, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. Syria says the fire that broke out in the western Latakia port this morning following an Israeli airstrike has been contained. Firefighters have managed to put out the flames that spread to container storage facilities. The air raid also damaged residential buildings, hospitals, and shops. But there has been no word on any casualties. The Syrian army says that Israel fired the rockets from the Mediterranean Sea. This is the second raid against Latakia this month. The Arab country faces frequent aggression by Israel, usually against its military facilities. Damascus calls these attacks a violation of its sovereignty and has been filing complaints with the United Nations. The Arab League is warning against Israel's new plans to expand settlements in the occupied Golan Heights, calling them null and void. The organization says Israel must stop its settlements or its attempts to change the demographic makeup of the territory and its legal status. The Arab League also noted the Golan Heights belong to Syria, and any Israeli settlements there violate international law. The regime is planning to double the number of settlers in Golan by building thousands of new units. Local residents turned out to protest the plan over the weekend. The Syrian residents say that Israel is seeking to forcibly remove them so as to make room for its illegal settlements. Hundreds of thousands more people in northern China will have to stay home as authorities are tightening COVID restrictions. China has already imposed a strict lockdown on 13 million people in the city of Xi'an, which is the new hotspot. And now nearby cities are introducing similar curbs after detecting new cases. There have been more than 200 new cases in the past 24 hours. That's very low compared to infections in Europe and the U.S. But China has a zero COVID strategy owing to tight border restrictions, quarantines, and lockdowns. Thousands of testing centers are now operating in Xi'an to help deal with the resurgence of the virus. At the beginning of this year, many hoped that life would return to something resembling normal. But 2 years into the coronavirus pandemic, masks, lockdowns, and social distancing measures are still in place. The global vaccination campaign has been underway. People are still suffering from the spread of COVID-19 across the world. New virus mutations are emerging, and an unequal vaccine uptake is preventing a global recovery. Here's Press TV's report on the pandemic and its impacts on the world for the year 2021.
2021 started with many people expecting a return to normalcy, but the coronavirus pandemic continued to blaze across the world. Over 274 million COVID-19 infections and more than 5 million fatalities. That's how this year is wrapping up, with the United States, Brazil, Mexico, the UK, India, and Russia named as the world's worst affected countries. This year, the world also struggled with the emergence of new variants of the novel coronavirus. In May, the World Health Organization named a new highly transmissible COVID strain previously detected in India as the Delta variant.
Delta variant is well on its way to becoming the dominant variant globally because of its significantly increased transmissibility.
6 months later, another variant with a large number of mutations stoked global fears.
So today, we are announcing B11529 as a variant of concern named Omicron.
This is while questions about the origins of COVID-19 still remain in place, following a series of inconclusive investigations by experts. But the highlight of the year was the authorization of a number of COVID-19 vaccines. As of December 2021, more than 4.4 billion people across the world were reported to have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. However, the distribution of these vaccines was nothing close to fair. While concerns over waning immunity prompted many countries to administer third and booster shots, people in some parts of the world fell victim to a strike and divide. Low-income countries were the recipients of less than 1% of vaccines administered in the world.
Vaccine inequality cannot be allowed to continue. Until everyone is vaccinated, everyone will continue to be at risk.
And while hundreds of millions of people were left vulnerable to this deadly virus, some simply chose not to get vaccinated.
No more shots!
We don't want no shots!
They turn us into mutants. They inject microchips in us.
The opposition was not only against vaccines. Many took to the streets, sometimes violently, to protest prolonged lockdowns and restrictions.
Oh, I just feel that it's gone too far.
with the lockdowns and the levels, and constantly being put into these positions.
It's tyranny. That's what it is. Absolute tyranny.
And at the center of all this was a negatively affected global economy. Despite signs of some imbalanced economic recoveries, many regions, including Europe, suffered record inflationary pressures. Border controls and travel curbs dealt a blow to international trade and tourism with an unprecedented attendance-free Summer Olympics. The service sector was hit hard, and so was the labor market, where many were either left unemployed or unwilling to return to their pre-pandemic jobs. Moreover, a surge in demand for a broad range of products caused supply chain backlogs. But again, low-income countries with low vaccination rates were disproportionately affected by the economic consequences of the pandemic. The World Food Program estimates that nearly 272 million people are already or are at risk of becoming acutely food insecure by only the end of this year. The world heads into 2022, while doubts linger on about the duration and the magnitude of the impacts of COVID-19. Nevertheless, the disastrous consequences of this pandemic have been a wake-up call, highlighting the many flaws of the global system. According to the WHO, the world's most vulnerable people are left without vaccines. Health workers are left without sufficient equipment to save lives, and the growing me-first mentality is preventing the solidarity required for dealing with a global threat.
Ending the pandemic is not a matter of chance. It is a matter of choice.
Therefore, in order to go back to a normal life, the world needs to adopt a unified approach and remember that nobody is safe until everybody is safe.
Well, that will come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for tuning in. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
You're listening to Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on Islamic Revolution. Thanks to Islamic Revolution, political dependence has been completely uprooted in our country. October 18th, 2017.
Political dependence came to an end thanks to the revolution. We were thankfully liberated, but that we are still dependent in terms of the economy and culture. We should work on this because dependence will lead to disaster. I will tell you that when I look at the memoirs which have been written by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's friends, I read that in certain cases, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi himself was extremely angry at the Americans. He sometimes cursed them. Of course, he did so in his private room and in the company of his close friends. He was like a person who goes to his rooftop and swears at a policeman in a distant city. He used to swear at them in his private room, but whenever the British and the US ambassador delivered a message, made a phone call, and issued a command, he was ready to bow to them and obey their command. He had no choice, and he had to do so. This is dependence. This should be destroyed. Well, political dependence has been completely uprooted in our country.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The Islamic Revolution moved the people from the periphery into the center. August 3rd, 2017.
From the beginning of the revolution, the people of Iran have played their role 12 times in electing the highest-ranking officials of the country. Moreover, the people's choices and votes have brought about 10 Islamic consultative majlises, 5 city and village councils, and 5 assemblies of experts. All these have been achieved thanks to the revolution. Our new generation should not forget certain things. We experienced the pre-revolutionary era with all our being. Before the victory of the revolution, the people did not have any role in the management of the country and in the appointment of the managers. Heads of countries, monarchs, kings, and their cohorts used to come and go, but the people were mere spectators. They did not have any role. The Islamic Revolution came and moved the people from the periphery into the center. This way, the people were given the power to choose everything.
Great powers of the world confess they can't resist the influence of Iran in West of Asia. June 7th, 2017.
The policies of the great powers in the world have become trapped in the mud in West Asia. These policies have failed. They themselves say that this failure is because of the influence and power of the Islamic Republic. This is very important. They wanted to impose every disaster that they liked on Iraq and Syria, but they failed. Well, this is very important. This is the same thing that you wanted. This is the very same thing that the revolution wanted. The goals of the revolution have been attained, but the goals of the US and its allies, not only the US, have not. This is only an example of such victories, capabilities, and achievements.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations General Assembly has backed an open-ended war crimes probe against Israel, including into the regime's recent 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip that killed at least 260 Palestinians, including over 60 children. An overwhelming majority of 125 countries voted in favor of the investigation. It was initially approved by the UN Human Rights Council in the aftermath of the Gaza War in May. The inquiry allows for a review of Israeli human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories. No such open-ended investigation has ever been launched against any other UN member. The vote came after Israel's amendment to defund the probe was rejected 125-8 with 34 abstentions. Israel itself and the United States were among the few that voted against the approval of the budget for the investigation. Palestine's permanent ambassador to the UN, Riyad Mansour, praised the vote and all the countries that rejected Israel's proposal. He thanked the UN General Assembly for approving all budgets of the programs relating to the Palestinian cause, including his request to increase funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees. Meanwhile, the U.S. envoy to the UN, who voted against the probe, said Washington will continue to oppose the investigation and to look for opportunities in Geneva to revisit its mandate. This is another example of how Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any prosecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes. Speaking of vetoes, the United States has vetoed dozens of United Nations Security Council resolutions critical of Israel, including at least 53 since 1972. Washington's unequivocal support of Israel has seen it thwart resolutions condemning violence against Palestinian protesters, as well as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank built since 1967. The U.S. has vetoed at least 4 UN Security Council resolutions condemning Israel's settlements on Palestinian land, which are considered illegal under international law. The U.S. support of Israel also has encouraged settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis.
Israel will prevent participation by people, by investigators. I don't think Israel will allow them into the country, whether it's this year or next year. As long as they have the backing of the United States, they continue to be able to refuse to deal with international condemnation and international investigation of the undoubted crimes that go on a daily basis against the Palestinian people.
Last week, to mark the 5th year since the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for an end to all settlement activities in the Palestinian territories, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, issued a statement calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He stated that one statistic above all illustrates the remarkable reluctance of the international community to enforce its own directions respecting the Israeli occupation. According to his statement, when Resolution 2334 was adopted in 2016, there were an estimated 400,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and 218 in East Al-Quds. 5 years later, there are 475,000 settlers in the West Bank and 230,000 in East Al-Quds, an increase of 12%. The surge in the number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories shows how Tel Aviv ignores the 2334 resolution that states Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease.
What allows the State of Israel to ignore the UN, many UN resolutions condemning the actions taken by Israel against the Palestinians on many different fronts, what allows Israel to continue to do that is the support that it has from the United States, that it's under the umbrella of United States protection. It's almost like Israel is the 51st state of the United States, the way that it's treated by the U.S. government. And this goes through Republicans and Democrats over the years. And so what it's done is it allowed these atrocities to go on.
Concluding his statement, the UN official said only an approach based on accountability, equality, and full rights for all can create the possibility of a prosperous and shared future for Palestinians and Israelis alike. But Tel Aviv has invariably avoided all attempts at bringing it to account over its decades-long aggression against Palestinians and other regional nations, thanks to staunch support by its oldest and strongest ally, the United States.
Prison is a disturbingly common experience for Palestinians. Since 1967, around one-fifth of Palestine's population has, at one time or another, been imprisoned. But the issue of Palestinian prisoners went viral on September 6th when the alarm at Israel's heavily guarded Gilboa prison went off following a jailbreak by six Palestinian inmates. Israeli authorities launched a manhunt for the inmates and toughened the situation for the rest of the prisoners, which prompted protests and hunger strikes that lasted for weeks. The spotlight, however, fell on six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners who were protesting their detainment without any trial under an Israeli policy dubbed administrative detention. On November 7th, some 4,500 Palestinian inmates went on a day-long hunger strike in solidarity with the six. Two of the hunger strikers, who had refused to eat for over 3 months straight, were later released. The strikes have shed new light on the plight of Palestinians in Israel's massive prison system, which currently holds over 4,500 political detainees and inmates on dubious charges. On top of that, Palestinian residents have been subject to violence by Israeli settlers who remain immune from any consequences. If anything, like the raid on the Palestinian village of Jalud in mid-May, Israeli troops come to the aid of the settlers and arrest the victims, not the aggressors. Rights groups say violent settlers are just another tool in Israel's inventory to remove the Palestinians from their lands. Their population is growing fast as the number of settlements built and planned to be built on the occupied territories are rising sharply. Israel pressed ahead with its land grab and expansionist policies like the many years before. It has razed, forced people to demolish, or seized multiple Palestinian-owned structures, including in East Al-Quds. In fact, such practices by Tel Aviv increased about 21% in 2021 compared to the year before. Israel has been increasingly evicting Palestinians from their homes, arguing that they lack permits. But it's virtually impossible for the Palestinians to obtain permits in areas including Area C and East Al-Quds. The evictions are usually done on such short notice that the residents cannot take the matter to the court. The United Nations says Israeli authorities have refused to grant permits to at least a third of Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, potentially placing over 100,000 residents at risk of displacement. Israel's plans to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, however, sparked an outcry that reverberated across the international community. Protests against the plan, especially those around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, turned violent, with Israeli troops cracking down on Palestinian demonstrators and storming the holy site in early May. That coincided with the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The tension sparked a conflict between Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli military in what turned into an 11-day war on the besieged enclave. The Israeli army razed several structures in the Strip, including a high-rise building that housed the office of several media outlets in Gaza, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. The Israeli atrocities drew widespread condemnation, with people around the world holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Some observers believe the war was a distraction from a lingering political uncertainty in Israel and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to postpone parliamentary elections that could have been a referendum on his rule. 2021 was a tragic year for Palestine. The events that unfolded over the past year proved that despite what some Arab nations claim, their normalization with Israel did not help the Palestinian cause, but might have even emboldened Tel Aviv to escalate its aggression on the Palestinians. The past year, however, was a year of unity and solidarity too, with Palestinians concluding that resistance is the only means to truly stand against the occupation and fight for freedom. The incidents and headlines in the past 12 months also raised awareness for more people across the world of how life is like for a Palestinian.
You're response, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the Islamic Republic will continue sanctions removal talks in the Austrian capital with seriousness. The Iranian foreign minister emphasized that Tehran will never give excessive concessions to the opposite side. Iran's foreign minister then criticized non-constructive stances taken by some European signatories to the nuclear deal with Iran during the previous round of talks in Vienna. In the previous negotiations, the positions taken by some European countries, especially by the French, were in general not constructive. We expect the French side to focus on playing a constructive role and help the progress of the negotiations. He also criticized the European side for not putting forward any new initiative in the talks.
I think the Europeans proved that they are unreliable since 2018 and throughout 2021, because when President Donald Trump rejected the JCPOA unilaterally, the European states who signed the JCPOA did not honor their signature and did not commit to what they have agreed upon with Iran. Therefore, it is absolutely clear that Iran cannot rely on the European states, particularly now we're talking about France and Germany, including Great Britain, that is no longer part of Europe, but it is within the European continent and it's one of the countries that signed the JCPOA.
The top Iranian diplomat recommended that the five remaining signatories to the JCPOA should have no doubt that if they want to give one concession and get 10 concessions in return, the Islamic Republic of Iran will never accept such an approach. The other parties are continuously doing interviews, saying that they are worried about the progress of Iran's nuclear program. We announced loudly that if you want to alleviate your concerns about Iran's peaceful nuclear program, all JCPOA-related sanctions against Iran must be removed. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue its strong talks in a logical manner until a good deal is reached. European Union's Deputy Foreign Policy Chief Enrique Mora, who represents the bloc in the Vienna talks between Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, and the EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell, are reported to be making efforts to focus on the negotiations with seriousness. Iran and the five remaining parties to the JCPOA resumed talks in Vienna on November 29 after a five-month hiatus, marking the first round of negotiations under President Ebrahim Raisi's administration and the seventh overall. During the seventh round of the Vienna talks, Iran presented two draft texts which addressed separately the removal of U.S. sanctions and Iran's return to its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. Iran and the P4+1 group of countries resumed the talks at the Austrian capital on December 9, when the participants returned to their capitals for additional consultations on the two draft proposals that Tehran had put forward. Since the U.S. administration under Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, the EU refused to play a constructive role to revive the deal. The European side pledged to do business with Iran through a mechanism which came to be known as the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges, or INSTEX, but the project ultimately failed due to the inaction of the European side and U.S. pressure, leaving Iran with no options but to scale back its JCPOA commitments within the limits of the deal. Meanwhile, the European Court of Justice has said that European companies can end contracts with Iranian firms pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank Meli against the Deutsche Telekom, however, the decision of the European bank is shameful.
The situation in the Israeli-occupied West Bank has become highly volatile. Israeli settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinian communities across the occupied territory. And Israeli forces have been using lethal force against the Palestinians more than often. Palestinian men, women, and even children have been losing their lives to Israeli gunfire.
2021 has been the deadliest year for Palestinian children since 2014. Increasingly frustrated with unending Israeli occupation, ongoing land grab, deadly violence, and lack of international action, some Palestinians have tried to take matters into their own hands by staging car ramming and stabbings against Israelis as some form of resistance against the regime. But the number of fatalities on the two sides is not comparable at all, as Israeli forces use disproportionate force against any form of protest or resistance against the regime. For years, human rights groups have accused Israel of following a shoot-to-kill policy. But things are apparently getting worse these days after the regime recently revised its open-fire policies. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank are now allowed to open fire on Palestinians who throw rocks or Molotov cocktails even when they don't pose an immediate threat.
I think what the regime is trying to achieve here can be expressed in two words. Dead Palestinians is what it's trying to achieve. One of the major objectives of Zionism is to clear Palestine of all Palestinians and have only Zionist Jews there.
The new open fire policy blatantly violates international law and has drawn widespread condemnation. Palestinians held a funeral on Thursday for a young man who was killed by Israeli gunfire. The mourning procession was held in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammad Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Such deadly shootings of Palestinians seem to be on the rise in the West Bank. On Tuesday, a Palestinian motorist was gunned down in the northern occupied West Bank after what the Israeli military said was an attempted car ramming of soldiers at a checkpoint. Israel seems determined to keep up its use of deadly force against the Palestinians even when there is no immediate threat. Earlier in December, the United Nations Human Rights Office said it was, quote, shocked by the apparent extrajudicial execution of a Palestinian man who had injured an Israeli with a knife, but was shot and lying on the ground. Israeli forces continued to shoot the man from point blank, even when he was posing no threat. Such shootings are undoubtedly extrajudicial field executions that violate international law. Will Israel's illegal and hard-handed tactics force the Palestinians into submission? Probably not, as Palestinian resistance groups are calling for intensified acts of retaliation against Israel across Palestinian territories. The leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad recently stressed the need for continued resistance operations in the West Bank, saying that the Zionist regime's aggression in the region would have serious consequences and that Tel Aviv would pay a heavy price for its aggressions.
The more oppression they bring upon Palestinians, the more resistance they're going to get. And in fact, this has been true historically for any people that are under oppression. When you're under oppression, you're going to resist, and there will be people who are willing to pay any price to resist.
The occupied West Bank could experience more tensions and deadly violence against the Palestinians in the coming weeks, as the Israeli regime refuses to change its dangerous course.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام كل مقتصر عليه كاف.
Amir al-Mu'minin Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Every small thing that he is contented upon suffices."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. We find, dear brothers and sisters, that the life and the persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, revolves around his words and his actions. One of the beautiful things about the words and the statements and the actions and the behaviors of Imam Ali alayhi salam is that they were in sync with one another. They were inseparable from one another. And so therefore, Imam Ali did what he said, and he said what he did. And this is true perfection in a human being. We don't just merely say that we follow the commands of Allah. We do follow the commands of Allah. We don't merely say, La ilaha illallah, there is no God except Allah. We live and we behave with this La ilaha illallah in our lives. Now it's interesting, we find that the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they were all very generous. They had this quality of sakhawat. They were the quality of generosity. They were known as sakhi, meaning generous. Now, it's interesting, but this generosity to was so great that they were well known and famous as being generous, and this was considered a part and parcel of their persona. Imam Ali alayhi salam is explaining this idea of sakhawat and this concept, this ideal of generosity, says that the ultimate degree of generosity is to give away what is in one's power. It's interesting, but we find that in the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there is this integral and this very fundamental pillar in his life, which is the persona of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, Salamullah alayha, peace and blessings upon her, the daughter of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. Truly, we find in the life of Lady Fatimatu Zahra that she did give away everything that was in her power to be able to give. There are many stories in the historical texts which show these different instances where Lady Fatimatu Zahra gave away her food. And likewise, Imam Ali gave away his food. Or Imam Ali, for example, it is well known that he would dig wells and then he would give it away in charity. He would plant trees and he would give these orchards of date trees away in charity. And this is one of the things that we learn from the persona of the Ahlul Bayt, and this is one of the things that we must follow if we are to be the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, and that is to be generous and to give away on the path of Allah and for the sake of Allah. Give away to the poor, give to the needy, help them. And of course, as Imam Ali says, the ultimate degree of generosity is to give away what is in one's power. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
محمدين وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
Oh Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
I try to talk about this spiritual status of Amir al-Mu'mineen, master of the spiritual masters. Not as Waliyul Awliya, but as Waliyullah. Now you will say, you know, how can Ali be the Wali of Awliya and also Wali of Allah? This is where you have to realize the richness of this language known as Arabic, the language of the Quran. Many words have actually not only multiple meanings, sometimes, you know, opposite meanings. On Fridays, we recite the special ziyarat of our 12th Imam. There is a statement there where we say, As-salamu alayka ya maulaya ana maulaka. You are saying salam to the Imam of the time, and you are saying salam to you, O Mawlaya, O my Mawla. And then you are saying, Ana Mawlaka, salam to you, O my Mawla, I am your Mawla. You are using same words when you address the Imam, and when then you describe yourself. What does it mean? Salam on you, O my master, and I am your master? No. Mawla in the first place means the master, referring to our Imam. When I say, Wa ana mawlaka, mawla there means I am your slave. Same word used mawla for the Imam as the master, same word used for mawla for myself in the meaning of slave. This is the richness of Arabic language. You have to look at the context to understand what does it mean. When we use the term wali, we say waliyul mu'mineen, waliyul awliya. We are looking at the relationship of Ali and those who are down. When we use the word wali for Ali in relation to other people, we take